November. Why am I here? Tasha looks up from the assembled pieces of the suit's left leg to find a dark shadow filling the doorway. Why am I here? He repeats, voice low and scream hoarse. He is speaking Russian. This is a bad night. It's also the 72nd time he's asked that question. He's been awake for 12 days. Hasn't had a flashback in 2, hasn't tried to kill her in 4. He's walked the perimeter of the house 326 times, spent 83.6 hours staring at a picture of him and Steve Rogers, has slept 18.7 hours in roughly 90-minute intervals, has woken screaming every time. Twice, Tasha found him back in his coffin, hands by his sides, shoulders scrunched against the tight confines. After she burned the 10 rings to the ground and escaped the desert, she found herself missing the cave. The dark, the damp, cool. She still has trouble sleeping without the steady drip of water in the far corner. She wakes screaming every time, too. And she hates that cave, those men, herself most of all. She stands, pushes the project aside, makes her way to another table. There's a half-finished arm on it. Come on, she tells him, points toward another chair. Sit, let's talk sensation feedback. It works, sometimes. Distracting him until dawn, when his muscles untense just a fraction. But tonight, well, why am I here? In 12 days, she hasn't once answered that question. Doesn't matter. I don't even know why I'm here. No one knows. People don't have a purpose. Accidents of evolution, chemicals, biology, geography. 2 people with just the right genetic material meeting at just the right time to create just the right mixture, which, under just the right conditions, becomes a person who is then shaped by just the right circumstances to meet another person with just the right genetic material. On and on and on, an endless chain of chaos and coincidence. Anyone who sees a purpose in there is more delusional than Tasha after too much to drink. People don't have a purpose. Heroes do. But Tasha is not a hero. Tasha makes plays she's a human being most times. More metal and chemicals in her veins than blood. She still dreams of explosions blooming on the horizon, and instead of terrified, she's awed. She looks at the suit and is amazed at what her hands built, at what she has created. She is proud like Icarus must have been proud of his wings, like the Winter Soldier's creator must have been proud of the monster they made, a bespoke killer at their beck and call. Tasha understands weapons. Weapons are built to destroy. She doesn't understand people. People have no purpose. I did, he answers, leaning across the table, hands clenching at the edge of it. The metal table creaks under his left. He spends his many waking hours between patrols and the damn picture, surfing the web with Jarvis's help, watching TV, listening to Tasha's music collection. Anything made before 1950 makes him recoil. When he screams in his sleep, it's always in English. When he's awake, he doesn't answer to his name, speaks Russian half the time, and carries her kitchen knives hidden up his sleeves. She calls him darling, calls him sweetheart and sugar plum, anything but winter, which is the only thing he answers to when he is awake. He's only Bucky in his nightmares. and Tasha doesn't know how to fix him. Doesn't know if she can. She used to make weapons. She never learned how to unmake them. When Tasha is done with something, it detonates. She is silent for too long, fiddling with a screw unconsciously. His eyes drift away from her face, towards the far corner, where the machines that came with him still stand for her to study. He looks at the chair that wipes memories with something akin to desire. She envies him that simplicity, the clarity, that must come from knowing that when everything is over, a simple press of a button will wipe him clean again, will make him innocent, make him pure again, until the next time he is woken and made to murder. Button. Clean slate. It should horrify her. She imagines life without remembering Afghanistan. Imagines life remembering the version where Obi died in a plane crash instead of at her hands. Feels no horror. Sure, she'd still be a monster, still be the merchant of death, the baby killer, but she wouldn't know. If you stick your fingers in your ears and squeeze your eyes shut tight, the nightmares can't find you. Because you survived, she blurts, unguarded, sudden. She hasn't slept in as long as he has. Hasn't spoken with anyone except Pepper via video conferences in 13 days. Hasn't seen another living thing except him. 288 hours and change, with nothing but him. He's as familiar now as Yinsen and her torturers were. Terrible, but there. Real. A comforting horror, slinking through her pristine white house in heavy boots, his face smeared black, his metal fingers gouging at her furniture. Jarvis ordered him clothes online, but he only wears black, keeps his face hidden behind his hair. His gaze refocuses on her faster than she can track. Curious. At the ready. We survived, and this... She knocks on the reactor. Feels the shock of it vibrate all the way up to her teeth. This is what we get for not knowing when to stay dead. His head cocks to one side, thoughtful. Punishment? Yes. No, a chance to do better. Redemption. He says it in English. No, because from some things there is no coming back. Tasha believes in improvement, not in goddamn time travel. Maybe. He stares for a moment longer, then nods, accepting her words if not the message. Makes his way over to his corner of the lab, climbs inside his coffin. Tasha follows like she's pulled on a leash, rests her hands on the metal edge of the cryo chamber. Sleep? She asks, unnecessarily. He nods. Sleep tight, babe. As she makes to move away, unable to watch him in there, his words stop her. My name is Winter. No, it isn't. He seems to consider, eyes closed serenely. It's not the other one either. Natasha Maria Stark went into a cave. Iron Man came out. James Buchanan Barnes fell into the ice. The Winter Soldier came out. We'll work on your arm tomorrow, okay, buddy? Yours is a travesty. He grunts, something like approval. Jarvis dims the lights above him without asking. He likes their new ghost. Tasha goes back to work.
The woman confuses Winter. She is brash, loud, and angry broken, but she is also kind. Her eyes are soft, sometimes, when she looks at him. He tries to place the expression, and finds it again in a woman he met in 1957. Her name was Anna. She was Russian, and she was a danger to Hydra. She knew secrets. So he went to her, and instead of killing her, he loved her. He pretended to need her help, as was his mission. And he pretended to be grateful when she gave it, as was his mission. He gained her trust, as was his mission. And when he knew all the secrets she had stolen, he carved out her insides, as was his mission. In between these things, she looked at him with those eyes, sometimes, soft and weak. When he came for her with a knife, she was not surprised. "I expected them to simply shoot me," she told him, her hand on his face. She smelled like apples. "Instead, they sent you. That is worse." "Why?" he asked, months out from the chair, the drugs. "Half a person again, for a few brief weeks." "Because they knew I could not be cruel to you." And he understood that the trap had not been his deception, but rather his reality. She had known from the first moment who and what he was. The kind of wretched thing she let into her home. And yet, somehow, she had not been able to deny him entrance, despite, or maybe because, of what he was. A monster. The woman looks at him like Anna did when he cut her open. Like she knows he is a monster and does not care. He went back, as was his mission, after it was done. His handler smiled, teeth half gone from chewing tobacco, and said, "For Hydra." He had always said that. After every dead body left in the cold, after every bloody child, man or woman, for Hydra. Long enough, often enough, for it to remain through the chamber, the chair, the drugs. For Hydra. Everything he hates is for Hydra. Natasha is not Hydra. She has soft eyes and hardened hands, a hole in her chest, and compassion for a wretched thing. Hydra would want her dead.
Tasha sleeps and dreams of day 5. Dreams of hearing screams all the way down in her lab, of running, letting Jarvis guide her feet to where Winter lay in bed, every muscle straining against invisible chains, his jaw clenched so tight she thought his teeth might crack. She wasn't dumb enough to shake him by the shoulder to get close. She considered taking his blanket, but the room was cold and she didn't know how he would react to it. He's been cold for so long. He kept screaming. Hoarse, animal sounds of pain. And in the end, Tasha did what Yinsen had. Grabbed his foot and pulled before leaping back to a safe distance. But Winter wasn't a sickly woman with a battery attached to her. Winter was something else entirely. And he came flying at her with a roar of rage, riding her to the ground with his thighs squeezed at her ribs, his metal hand wrapped around her neck, cutting off air. She batted at his arms, his chest, felt the loose parts of her ribs where her sternum wasn't there to hold them in place anymore, grind together, felt them move, wild dark eyes above her, no recognition in them. Speaking with her last bit of air, she called out in Russian, "It's okay, it's okay. Only a dream." Like the dream of water filling her lungs and making her choke. Like the dream of waking while nimble fingers cut her bones from her chest. He didn't react. He didn't react, and for the longest seconds, Tasha thought she would die here, crushed and asphyxiated by the Russian boogeyman. In reality, he woke up from his waking nightmare after a second or two, released her to scramble back until she hit the wall, arms wrapped around herself, relearning to breathe without tasting stale water. In her dream, he keeps squeezing, and her lungs fill with tepid, moldy cave water. Her chest cracks open like an egg, and Winter digs around in it, smirking with sharp teeth, lapping at the blood on his hands. Her blood. This time, Tasha wakes screaming. She clutches the reactor with one hand, fumbles for the light with the other, finds a shadow looming at the end of her bed, large and broad and deadly. Remembers that glinting hand around her frail human neck. "Nightmare," he rumbles. And for once, she can't tell if it's English or Russian. Just breathes in and out, in and out. He waits until her fingers uncramp, until she finds the light, until she's okay. He waits, silently and motionlessly, the horror in her bedroom, the monster she dreamed about. "Only a nightmare," he repeats, smiles twistedly. "You said that in your sleep." He knows. What she dreamed about, he knows. "Thank you." With a nod, he leaves, door shutting behind him quietly. She hears no receding footsteps. "Jarvis, where is he?" Hesitation.
"Mr. Barnes seems to have settled in front of your bedroom door, Miss Stark. Would you like me to ask him to leave?"
Tasha wraps her arms around her torso, squeezes, feels bone grinding against metal, a sensation that sends chills up and down her entire body. She shakes her head. "Let him stay." He's chewing on his fork. Again. Tasha reaches over, slowly, and pulls it from his hand. He lets it go because sometimes he gets weirdly passive, and she puts it on the table. A minute later, he's gnawing on his spoon. He doesn't even seem to notice he's doing it. "Jesus," she realizes. "You've got an oral fixation." And then, "Oh my god, you're from the 40s. You were probably a smoker." "Smoker." He sounds confused, so she repeats it in Russian. He shrugs noncommittally. In the name of identity finding, Tasha starts digging through the junk drawer for that one pack of cigarettes she keeps on hand. She stopped when she was 20, and when she was 22. It stuck by 25. Booze was always more her speed anyway. She holds the squished pack out to him, considers that this might be a bad idea. Unhealthy, habit-forming, all that shit. But then, the likelihood of the man across the table dying from cancer are really, really low. And anyway, before she can rethink her decision, he's plucking the pack out of her hand, shaking out the lighter and a cigarette with practiced ease, lighting it, inhaling. He stares at the curling smoke, almost surprised. Yep, you're a smoker. Were. Are again. I think I did this a lot. Before. With others, but not. He trails off. She waits for him to finish the sentence, but he never does. Just sits there and watches his hand as it moves to and from his mouth. His fingers as they tap the ash into his empty glass. The cherry as it glows. Brighter, dimmer, brighter, dimmer. Fixated. Tasha makes a mental note to have Jarvis find out what people smoked during the war and see if any of those brands still exist. She also plans to give Winter the talk about smoking and laws and health issues. But not tonight. But not tonight. Tonight, she lets him remember that he is a smoker. Obi's funeral falls on the 6-month anniversary of the first time he killed her, with a bomb with her name on it, in a desert, in a cave. His official death wasn't until 10 days ago, and celebrity funerals take a long time to plan, apparently. She thinks of bombs, and soldiers making peace signs, of waking during surgery and someone screaming in Dari, Urdu, something. She remembers being 17 and breaking down crying in Obi's arms because her parents are dead, and she may have hated them, but she also loved them. She thinks of the nameless man sitting in her living room, watching her speech televised on CNN. He's been speaking English for 3 days straight, and when she left for the funeral, Pepper threatened to quit for real if she didn't show up. He twisted his lips in something like a smile, and told her she looked beautiful. And dangerous. Like a knife, he said. The knife block in her kitchen has been empty for 17 days. She tells the mourners how Obi was a second father to her, how she loved him as much as she loved Howard, enjoys the irony. Thinks of how she could simplify the hydraulics in the arm she's building, shave off a few more grams, lighten the strain on the shoulder. Obi's life was cut tragically short, and he is going to be sorely missed. Natasha feels the California sun heating up her arc reactor to the point of discomfort. Thinks of the scarred skin around the shoulder port Winter hasn't let her more than catch a glimpse of so far. She spent time fiddling with the theories of bionics, robotics, trying to figure out if she could make the reactor more a part of her, control it, meld metal and nerve endings. It's not viable for her. And there's no point anyway. But it is for him. If she does it right, she can give him back sensation in his fingers, even if only a little. She smiles all the way through 1,000 condolences and calculates finger joints in her head without ever losing the thread of conversation. Afterwards, she escapes in the limo, waving coyly at Pepper and Rhodey, both of whom look furious and worried in equal measures. 5 drinks in, Happy tries to talk to her. 6 drinks in, she closes the privacy screen. 8 drinks, and the car pulls to a halt. She wobbles only a little, hasn't had breakfast, closes the door with a bang, climbs out of her heels, and stumbles. Smacks into cold metal and warm skin. He pulls her upright, studies her face. You look like hell, he observes. And she laughs, even though it's not a joke. Probably. He lost the empty look in his eyes by day 13, blue filling with something more solid than ghosts and memories. Not by a lot, but anything is better than a haunting horror in her home. He talks more since then. There's personality somewhere under 70 years of recalibration. I love funerals. She gives him a coy look, presses against his chest too hard, plays a dangerous game without meaning to. He hooks his flesh arm under one of hers across her back, pulls her back. Easy handling. A snort. I could tell. Then, let's have pizza and watch a movie. You are adjusting to this century remarkably well. You're welcome, he answers. And this time it's definitely a joke. It's good, she decides, that he can still make those. That he's not too broken. He's her kind of person, really. Sometimes, during training missions in Siberia, he ran into wolves. Packs, sometimes lone ones. He only killed them when he had to. He liked them, the way they moved, how they were deadly and graceful, and took care of their own. All the cold didn't seem to touch them. Once, a lone wolf followed him back to the compound, stuck around for days. It wasn't right in the head, like lone wolves so often are. He fed it a time or two, out of pity, watched it make friends with some of the soldiers, and then, the night before he was scheduled to go back into the ice, he heard two scientists joke about catching the wolf, experimenting on it. Making the Winter Soldier a pet, wouldn't that be a lark? He snuck outside that night, not caring about the punishments he was sure to receive, and played with the wolf for a while. Afterwards, it lay down next to him, an arm's length away. He waited until it fell asleep and broke its neck. Natasha reminds him of a wolf. Dangerous and wild and graceful and not quite right in the head. Not quite sane. She touches him, trusts him, falls asleep next to him like that wolf did, and it would be so easy to reach over, break her neck. Not even a strain with his left arm. Easier still. Take her heart, pull it out of the ruin of her chest. The bones are already spread open like a butterfly's wings, pinned in place by metal screws and determination. He watched her today, on TV, as she stood at a podium in bright sunlight and bared her teeth at the world. It looked like a smile, but her lipstick reminded him too much of blood for him to not know it was really a snarl. He killed me, was all she said earlier over pizza. So I killed him. She meant the man she mourned in a black dress only hours earlier, and he thought of wolves ripping apart the carcass of a man he'd killed. A hunter, interfering with training. He had worn pelts in grays and browns, and he had brought the man down with a knife, left him to bleed out into the snow. Watched the wolves converge, golden eyes glowing. They might be the only animals that understand hate. His gaze lands on the woman asleep on his flesh shoulder, and he wishes, with sudden clarity, that he had been the one to kill Obadiah Stain for her. To spare her from having to do it. To avenge her. Not because she has been kind to him. Not because she reminds him of that lonely, crazy wolf that, for some reason, loved him. Not because her eyes remind him of Anna. Not even because her interference made it so he actually remembers the wolf now. Remembers the woman who loved him only a little. Not even because they are so much alike, her and him, monstrous each in their own way. She told him what she did in Afghanistan.
How she made sure everyone in that camp died in flames. Hydra would want her dead. That's half the reason he needs her to remain alive. Perhaps, he thinks, it is time to tell her. Half a continent away, a man sits in a small room. The walls are white, as is the ceiling. The bed is made of wood. He has tried to describe the exact shade, hasn't succeeded. There are also a bedside table with a flower vase and a radio on it, a desk, a chair, and a window showing a fake view of a city he knew long ago. Yesterday, it feels like. He has sketched the view, and the room, 100 times, has tried to find that exact shade of brown, switched to charcoal when he couldn't. He does sit-ups for hours, reads what they give him, throws a ball against the wall, catches, throws, catches, throws. This is what going mad feels like. Suddenly, steps, outside his room, coming closer. The heavy gait of a powerful man, but one who has learned to move quietly. Director Fury, Steve greets, as soon as the door opens to reveal the older, younger man. Captain, the director returns. At ease, this isn't military. Steve relaxes automatically at the order, sits back down on the edge of the bed. What brings you here? He asks. Tries not to sound too eager. Fury pulls a thick paper file out of the depths of his ever-present coat, places it on the desk, turns his eye back on Steve. Captain? He asks. And for someone who claims he is not military, he sure uses Steve's title a lot. How would you like to come out of retirement? The next morning, Tasha is standing in the kitchen, trying to talk the coffee maker into making coffee faster, with marginal success. Well, actually, the only success is that Jarvis is unabashedly poking fun at her, but that is success because her AI is capable of being a sarcastic asshole. She feels accomplished. Her shadow comes slinking in just as she starts praying to the coffee gods. She stops, waves. Morning, babe. He nods, sits at the island, watches her flounder until, finally, caffeine, thank all the non-existent deities. You want? She asks, holding up her mug. To demonstrate. Not to offer. He can get his own. With a shrug, he slips off his stool and makes his way over, putting a mug under the spout, and then pressing all the right buttons like he's been doing it a lifetime. He waits for the final drip of coffee that always comes a few seconds after everything should be done, pulls sugar out of the cupboard, and heaps 3 spoonfuls into the mug. Then he sits back down, and catches her dopey gaze. Cocks his head, a silent question. It's weird, really, how well she reads his body language. Usually, Tasha is shit with silent people, just talks right over them. If you want to be heard in her presence, you better be damn loud. Or persistent. Better yet, both. But Winter rarely speaks at all. Just nods, shrugs, follows her around like a slightly homicidal puppy, and still, she hears him. You learn quickly, she admits, a little impressed. It's not hard. A wry grin flickers across his face, and he tucks the hair on one side of his face behind his ear. That's something new. Something he didn't do even 3 days ago. It's like these little things, gestures, words, opinions, desires,
Like, they trickle back in one by one, piece by piece. Like a really fucked up game of Tetris, creating something like a person. Or a well-built imitation of one, at least. He becomes more solid every day. Tasha fights the urge to reach up, touch the tips of her fingers to the reactor. He becomes more, she becomes less. She's about to make a joke, start some inane conversation to distract herself, when he reaches over, pushes the hand with her mug down until the porcelain rests on the counter. Then he informs her.
He was there once when they unfroze me.
Who?
Your Obi.
Not mine, she snaps reflexively, before the words even register.
Then she freezes momentarily, shakes her head.
No way, honey. Obi wouldn't have... But he absolutely would have, wouldn't he?
Obi, with the big, warm hands inside her chest and the sweet, low voice inside her ear.
He would have.
What? What did he do?
The freeze-dried Russian instant assassin is looking at her with pity in his gaze. She grinds her teeth, feels her jaw ache, sips her coffee with forced control.
Talk. Watch. It was a demonstration, I think.
What? Sit, fetch, heal? His metal fingers spasm around the mug. Tasha didn't know porcelain could creak.
Then he candidly lays it out for her. She doesn't know if he hasn't yet regained the capacity for shame, or if it's permanently deleted from his repertoire, but he talks about murder like he talks about the weather.
Two men. Brothers. Deserters. Traitors to the cause.
It was... an example. A warning.
Do not betray the Hydra, because the Hydra is many, and it will find you.
He tilts his head again, thinking.
On their mother's front lawn. Dawn made them look like broken toys.
Tasha remembers the dissonance, the powerful, violent terrorists so still and twisted in the sand, like dolls abandoned by angry children. The blood soaked into the ground too fast to really look red. Dirty brown, like a negative image of death. Then, fire. She picks the least horrible part of his report. So detached. So cool.
He broke so prettily, she thinks. So neatly. Right down the middle, and all his humanity came leaking out. She wonders what her excuse is.
Hydra went down after 1945, she corrects. It's what you died for, babe. The end of Hydra.
A head shake. Cut off one head and two will take its place. Hail Hydra.
You're serious?
Yes. Then, this is what I fell for.
No, you fell for a man called Steve Rogers. You fell for a guy wearing the American flag and trying to fix the world. You fell for a boy from Brooklyn.
She says none of it.
Remembers vaguely hearing about how it's a bad idea to force information on amnesia victims. She has tried to keep it to basics, to not overwhelm him. It's why he spends most of his nights staring at that one photograph she gave him.
She didn't give him more than that. Didn't dare.
She shrugs, which is lame and not useful at all, but it's not like she actually knows. Every bit of knowledge she has about Bucky Barnes is second or third hand. Through Howard for the facts, through Aunt Peg for the more emotional bits. Those boys loved each other enough to die for one another. Bucky dying? It killed something inside Steve. Made him colder. Peggy said once, on the rare occasions she gave in to Howard's nagging and got drunk with him. Tasha snuck into the study after he was out cold. Found her honorary aunt leafing through an old photo album. Maudlin and lonely and old. When she says nothing, something of the cold detachment bleeds from his gaze, leaving his eyes warmer, softer. Marginally. More person again. Tasha is glad, hums into her mug, and stuffs down all the memories of Peggy, Obi, and dead boys in ice, haunting her father's every step.
Hydra, huh? With a nod, he explains. Everything I remember, every murder I committed, was in their name. Everything. I want them dead. They screamed. When Tasha turned the flamethrowers on them, they screamed. Hydra. Okay, then. She can help him with that. On the second go-round, the warehouse doesn't look nearly sinister enough for what it contains. Nondescriptive, gray, drab, neat. No sunken roof, no flickering lights, no blood smeared on the walls. Nothing. Tasha actually stops, blinks against the dissonance for a moment. Winter stands beside her in a hoodie and sunglasses, his metal arm hidden under a glove. The only thing giving the prosthetic away is the mechanical sounds it makes as he moves. She really needs to step up production on a new one. Silent, smoother, less maintenance. It's kind of embarrassing when your super assassin keeps losing screws. And they hurt when she sits on them on the sofa. They stand in front of the spray-painted doors. D for destruction! And wait. For what? She has no idea. A signal, maybe. For someone to make a punny comment? When it doesn't happen, Tasha just punches in the code and waves her companion through. He takes in the entirety of the stash. The weapons. The secrets. The sins. Does he realize he was one of those things until 2 weeks ago? Does he know the empty space in the last row is where he spent the last 14 years? She knows better than to ask. Keeps her mouth shut just this once, thanks a lot. What are we looking for? A manifesto confessing to everything Hydra has ever done, preferably in chronological order. You know, smoking guns, bloody knives, big, glaring signs that say secret lair here. Barring that, anything traceable. Money, goods, people, anything I can track with a computer. Anything that can prove his words true. Anything that'll convince Tasha her father's monster, the many-headed snake, is still alive. After that, she has no idea what the fuck she's going to do after that. After she finds that proof. Because she knows there will be proof. What happens after that? I have no idea. She tags on, mostly to herself. Hydra is a problem, but it's not really her problem. If they have been operating in silence for 70 years, she doubts they'll ever bother her or hers. But he asked her for help. And that, she thinks that might be a thing decent people do. Help the torture victims they found in other people's secret weapon stashes get a leg up on their torturers. He stops. Already halfway down the first corridor. Turns back to her. He flings his hood off his head and stares at her, long and hard. After that, he says, very carefully and evenly, I killed them all. Great. So her research is going to amount to a kill list for him to pick off. Awesome. She doesn't realize she said that out loud until he takes a few steps back towards her, demands, do you have a problem with that? It's a dangerous question. But Tasha left nothing but blood and ashes in her wake when she escaped from the godforsaken desert. Left no one to remember her weak and hurt and trapped. And she can't really begrudge him the same. He deserves to murder each and every person who has ever seen him frozen and helpless, or awake and wiped. Slowly. Precisely. That probably makes her a bad person or something. She'll survive. No. He smiles again, that half thing he has been doing more and more lately, and disappears between piles of Obi's dirty secrets. It's a photo negative of all the smiles Howard's newsreels saw so long ago. A dark waif of a thing. But she'll take it. Tasha picks the opposite direction from Winter and walks. So it turns out that most banks do not think it's very important to digitize 70-year-old banking information. Especially not if they used to maybe be Nazi banks. Yes, we used to keep the gold teeth of murdered people in our vaults. Here is how. Who knew, right? They give up on the money after an hour of Jarvis running his servers hot, looking for data that is simply not there. But that still leaves people and things to track, and they're luckier there. They end up dragging anything paper toward the empty space where a coffin used to be, and before long, they're sitting on the ground, cross-legged, surrounded by piles and piles of outdated information. A few names, none of which mean anything to Winter. He knows faces, not names, he tells her. Sometimes, rarely, there are photos to go with the names. Armin Zola was a small, sweet-looking man with round glasses and chubby cheeks. I remember him. He cut off what was left of my arm. Tasha freezes, eyes wide, not sure what to say. Sorry doesn't cut it, and it's bullshit anyway. I know how much it hurts when someone cuts into your bones. Seems a bit too familiar. Apart from attempted murder and waking each other from nightmares, they don't really know each other very well. He doesn't need her to react, though. Taps just above his elbow. Ripped off here. I was awake. For the surgery. Taps his port to illustrate. Tasha snorts unprettily. I woke up in the middle of it. Kept screaming until someone covered my mouth and nose. Made me pass out again. For a second, they both stare at each other's horrors. Then they both laugh. It's not funny, but they laugh. God, she mutters. Look at us. What a pair. Damaged People Anonymous. We should start a group. DPA for short. DPA? He asks, rolling to his feet with too much grace to be entirely human. He's not very good at passing. Failed German super soldier serum experiment, she remembers. He makes his way over to her, plops down by her side, and plucks her phone, and by extension her AI, out of her lap. Starts typing with his flesh hand. She's gonna have to develop some sort of synth skin glove for him to use touchscreens with his metal arm. High-tech prosthetics are on her to-do list already. Might as well add artificial skin. Did they have Alcoholics Anonymous when you were a real boy? I don't know how old those are. Self-help groups where you go anonymously to talk to others with the same problem. Booze, narcotics, sex addiction, you name it, damage. There should be an A group for damage. So, DPA? Wanna join? He stops typing, waits a moment. Jarvis pipes up.
Thank you, sir. That is indeed useful information. I shall endeavor to track Mr. Zola immediately.
Winter nods, drops the phone. She plucks it from his lap without hesitation, looks at it long enough to see he gave Jarvis all he knew about the man. Age, nationality, what fields he worked in, what languages he spoke. Things that might be of use when looking for a man who'd gone to ground a long time ago. Winter leans around her briefly, grabs the stack of vials he was working on, and then goes back to flipping through them, their knees close enough to brush occasionally. And it strikes Tasha suddenly as strange. They wake each other when the screaming gets too much. They eat together. They avoid each other's paranoid quirks. They have known each other for a bit over 2 weeks. Tasha unfroze him and he didn't kill her and that's all. They don't know each other at all, but somehow here they are, inside each other's space. Strangers. But strangers who have been inside each other's nightmare. They are so terribly familiar with each other. You don't have to stick with me, you know that, right? She blurts, apropos of nothing. I mean, I'm fairly sure you don't have any hidden triggers inside your skull, so you probably won't kill anyone. Much. You could go. I'd set you up with some money, a car, no problem. You don't have to stay here. Holding up the beige folder in his lap, he quirks an eyebrow at her. Okay, yeah. Revenge. Tasha knows from revenge. Still. We don't have to live together for that. She is a bit worried, to be honest, that he's imprinting on her like a baby duckling on its mama. Or, you know, like a traumatized person on the first human being to show them kindness, like she did on Yinsen, but she's not making that comparison. They already have way too much in common for her to keep any kind of distance. Case in point, his free hand on her knee, squeezing. Not even Rhodey or Pepper touch her freely, without warning. Not anymore. Obi did. But Obi burned. Do you want me to leave? She actually considers it. Considers waking with his shadow looming over her, and how he sits in the lab for hours watching her work. How he turns his artificial shoulder away from direct sunlight and sleeps inside his coffin. How he calls her by her name with a Russian lilt to it that no one's ever had before, and let her fall asleep on him after the funeral, drunk and full of the carnage in her head. It would be easier if he left. So much easier. Especially with what's coming. But it's already too late, isn't it? He has imprinted on her like a damaged baby duckling, and she's imprinted right back. Their pee's in a fucking pod. DPA, she tells him. Meetings daily. If you survive the first year, you get shit all, except maybe less nightmares. After a beat, he nods. I think Zola had a student. This one here, Schuler. He would have taken him along. Then, an afterthought, a bit offbeat, he adds. I'll bring the snacks. Tasha laughs.
Brock Rumlow's strike team is impressive. 7 men and 1 woman,
all of them tall, muscled, and dressed uniformly in black combat gear. Their faces are narrow, their eyes flinty, and their shoulders tight, ready for battle. Steve has read all their files. Rumlow, call me Brock, Cap, leads the team. Rollins, his second-in-command, is their sniper. Chance, the only woman, is their demolitions expert. All of them are former special something. All of them have a CV a lot more impressive than Steve's. They are, according to the director, the pinnacle of the modern soldier. They make Steve uncomfortable. He has no doubt that the team was chosen for the dual reasons of A, being able to keep up with him, and B, being similarly structured as the commandos back in the day. 70 years. Goodness, Bucky has been dead for 70 years. He can't... Strike is built like the commandos were. A sniper as a second-in-command, a team for long, dirty missions deep in enemy territory. He thinks they're supposed to make him feel at home. But they miss the mark by a mile. What made Steve's unit special during the war wasn't their constellation, their specialties. It was that they were different. A ragtag bunch of men from all over, different ages, experiences, ways of life. They were good. Because if one of them was out of ideas, another one stepped in and filled the gaps. Between them, there wasn't anything they didn't know, or could at least fake. It saved their lives time and again. Strike seems artificial in comparison. Factory built to whatever today's standards for good soldiers are. They're yours, Director Fury had told him. Captain America needs a team. And Steve bit his tongue, bit it hard to swallow. Captain America had a team. Peggy is a shadow of herself, old age eating her mind bit by bit. All the others are long buried, heroes' funerals for all of them. One body left in ice, another in snow. Some nights... Steve dreams of finding Bucky, as alive as he is, as young and mad and wonderful as he ever was. Greeting Steve with a rap of his knuckles on a bony shoulder and a press of lips against his temple, quick and comfortable. But Steve hasn't been bony in a long time, and Bucky fell so far. He is torn out of his musings by Brock finishing sparring with one of his... there, men. Trevor's... The other man slings a towel over his shoulder, drops down next to where Steve is sitting, watching. Kid keeps neglecting his left, Brock grumbles after a minute of silence, during which Chance and Rollins peel Trevor's off the mats, poking fun at him for losing all the while. Steve shrugs. So put Michael's on his left. They mesh well, and he'll be covered. Brock throws him a surprised look. You think? When Steve just nods, he nudges the shield, leaning against his knees, with a foot. Think you can teach one of us a few moves with that? Might come in handy, in a jam. Someone able to use your weapon. Bucky could use the shield. So could Dum Dum. Triplet never quite got the hang of it. I don't think... He stops. Starts over. The way I move with the shield would leave a normal human with broken bones. I'm sorry, but I don't think that's a good idea. He doesn't notice that movement in the gym has ceased until Brock claps his hands, a beat too late to be casual, and it rings throughout the room. He nods like he understands, but he sounds almost petulant when he says, All right, then. We'll just have to trust you to have our back with that thing, won't we? We're a team, Steve assures him. But all that gets him is a quick nod before the team leader calls out. Trevor's, again. Mickey, I want you on his left. You're up against Morgan and Ramirez.
Miss Stark, I have found something interesting pertaining to known former Hydra strongholds and the cleanup project.
Jarvis announces. At 2:31 a.m., speaking quietly so as not to wake the one-armed bandit sleeping 6 feet away. Tasha yawns, digs herself out of the stack of files she's buried herself in, and asks,
What's that?
To her left, the AI activates one of the holo tables and pulls up a map. Certain places flare orange, like an explosion. Tasha picked the color when she marked off places likely to have illegally obtained SI weaponry. As soon as she reaches the table, several more locations flare blue. 7 of them overlap.
It seems Hydra, or what is left of it, possesses your weapons.
Makes sense, she mutters to her old friend. I hope he dealt with them. Then she slumps, leaning her elbows on the edge of the holographic field. Hydra has SI weapons. Well, that complicates shit.